coming up on this edition of Open Source.
Beauty is what inspires me. Nature, a good film, watching someone else who is a master of their craft, whether it's Carl Lewis running or Sugar Ray Leonard boxing or a Leonardo da Vinci painting. It's just watching somebody at the top of their level do their thing is always inspiring.
That's all next on Open Source. As a guitarist, Wayne Girard has traveled the world performing with superstars such as Stevie Wonder, Bob James, Stanley Clarke, and the list goes on. Girard's life as a sideman is just a chapter in his story. He's also composed music for national television advertising campaigns and Hollywood films. In addition to that, he's earned a platinum record for a K-pop song he produced for the supergroup SS501. Wayne Girard, welcome to Open Source.
Oh man, thank you for having me. It's such an honor. I'm so glad to be here. How are you, man?
Fantastic. Here's a question for you. When you look in the mirror, you get up in the morning, who is Wayne Girard?
Oh man, well, you know, that's a really, really good question. I think he's a guy who just tries to do the best job that he can, whatever assignment that he happens to be blessed to get. You know, a lot of different opportunities have come my way, and I've always tried to find out what that challenge is and give it 100%, you know? And so I've been very blessed to be successful in that.
Do you see yourself, I mean, you wear a lot of hats. Do you see yourself as a musician, as a composer, as a tech person? How do you see the world?
Yeah, that's a good question as well. So I think really at heart, I am a composer. So when I first started out playing, so here's a funny story, but I, at 12 years old, I accompanied a cousin of mine who won tickets to go see Kiss at Cobo Hall. And nobody, being a young black girl, none of her friends would go with her. So in my house, my parents, my mom especially being a church goer and a fledgling Motown singer, always had musical instruments at the house, organs and whatnot, guitar and this and that. And so I always kind of had the shining. And my cousin knew this, so she called me up and said, hey, would you like to go to this concert? I said, sure. I didn't know what it was. And we went, and seeing that performance of Kiss live at Cobo Hall just kind of ignited something in me. And I played bass for years. I was a bass player for a long time. And I found it limiting in the sense that I wanted to write songs and get into harmony and just be more of a front guy, whereas I saw bass playing at the time, while I understood the importance of it, I really wanted to be out front. So I started really diving into the guitar, taking songs apart, learning harmony, starting with Roy Orbison and the Beatles, and just kind of going forward, I think.
As you evolved as a musician, as you grew, and you got opportunities to travel, say with Stevie Wonder, what's that experience like? We see it on television or on YouTube, but what's it like for a musician such as yourself doing that?
That's a really good question, because I started young. I got a lot of really amazing opportunities being young, I think just because of the fire that I brought to those situations. It's very, you learn a lot about yourself. You learn a lot about the road. You learn a lot about discipline and about kind of learning how to make yourself part. Because I spent so much time growing up playing instruments and in my bedroom learning songs off records and whatnot, I never really was a sports guy. So I never learned that team ethic. So that's what I learned on the road, is how to be part of a team, how to support, not make it about me, but make it about the unit, which led me to develop other skills, like when I started to score movies or commercials and things like that. Those abilities to not make it about me, but to be about supporting the story or the product or the through line that the ad agency has brought up really was honed by playing with those artists, I think.
So let's talk about the opportunities you had to compose. Let's start with the advertising campaign. You said it's the through line. How much pressure and how much stress is on you during those opportunities?
Well, it depends on where the opportunity comes from. So at the time where I was really, really making a go in the ad world, I had a couple agents that were working for me. And so we would have to, like most ad houses now, music houses now, you have to bid on the job. And it's based on what you've done previously. And, you know, you have to provide samples and whatnot. And so they usually give you a spec sheet with a treatment of how the commercial is going to go, how long it should be, what beats they want you to hit, if it's going to be humorous, if it's going to be sad or whatever. So if you want to keep the job, there's a lot of pressure to deliver in that sense. But it becomes half craft, half inspiration, right?
Wow. And so what are some of the, for the people listening, what are some of the advertising campaigns that you've worked on?
So I did a Hanes hosiery commercial, which was a lot of fun. I love women, so it was really nice. They kind of wanted a kind of bawdy, vaudevillian rock track, kind of like ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da. So, but we couldn't do that, so I had to come up with something similar to that. So I've done that. Harley Davidson had a... I think when they were going for more of the Steppenwolf kind of keep your motor running campaign, I did that. I did a Dodge Ram campaign. We've done commercials for, when I say we, I had a production house, which was me and another guy who was basically doing my studio assistant, and he was also helping with some of the booking. And so Mercury, Jaguar, we did a Jaguar spot. We did a Mustang spot with Louis Resto, actually, who went on to be Eminem's producer. We did a spot with him. So things like that.
Where does creativity come from for you?
Well, so I would say it's 50% craft and 50% inspiration. So creativity for me, it starts with just having a solid foundation in harmony. I went to Wayne State and got a degree in jazz composition. And so it really taught me a lot about arranging and how certain keys or chords can suggest mood and this and that. So I can always start a track, right? But being inspired, sometimes I need to see beauty is what inspires me. Nature, a good film, watching someone else who is a master of their craft, whether it's Carl Lewis running or Sugar Ray Leonard boxing or a Leonardo da Vinci painting. It's just watching somebody at the top of their level do their thing is always inspiring. Prince is very inspiring to me. I would say as a young black man, he is probably the sole defining person in my life that I never had an opportunity to meet or work with. But everything from his look to his craft to his striving for excellence to his ability to mine different styles to his acceptance of himself, I could just go on and on, but I think Prince is probably the single most defining person for me at this point.
Now, I didn't expect to hear that. I really didn't. Prince. Wow. Okay. And I get it, but I just didn't expect to hear you say that. I don't know. So you've done the music thing. You've kind of, you ventured into like beats and stuff like that. And we've chatted about this in the past, but tell me about how you went from beats and then you evolved from there and why.
So I was it's really a long, long road and I'll try to make it as succinct as possible, but I also being the hotshot guitar player in my neighborhood, also met other hotshot guitar players, of one who was Jeff Bass, who I met when he was a member of a local Minneapolis-style group. Around here, there was quite a few. I was in one called Film at 11, but there was also Ready for the World, came from Flint. And then there was one here that got signed to Quincy Jones' label Quest called Dream Boy. And Jeff Bass was a guitar player in that group. And so we always kind of had a rival thing, but we also developed a friendship. And we lost touch after a while. And I got a call out of the blue to just come hang out with him one time. And little did I know, he was the primary beat maker and producer for Eminem. His brother had basically discovered Eminem and groomed him to kind of be the success that he is now. And so I got pulled into that world. I always had a love of hip hop, starting from KRS-One and Public Enemy, Ice Cube and NWA. That was always really, always a big part of my musical thing. But I never really dove into making beats or whatever, because I was always a guitarist, a jazz, more or less. But being in that environment, I learned how to make records and how to make beats working with Jeff and Mark. And eventually that relationship ended and I went off on my own and started making beats, which led me to making quite a few inroads into not only the hip hop community, but also into ads and things like that, because everybody wanted the hot sound, which at the time would have been, I guess this would have been the 50 Cent era. And so anyway, I graduated from using hardware into software because it was easier, it was more affordable, it was more available. But little did I know, not only was it available to me, but it was available to people around the world. And so as I was making beats and perfecting my craft, so were so many people around the world. And so it became very challenging to try and just make beats and just.
And so what you're saying, though, is that the technology evolved to the point where even as a musician, the playing field got leveled so that other people who weren't as accomplished as musicians as you were able to compete with you.
Which is, that's exactly right. And to be honest with you, I think that's good for a lot of reasons. I think that people, everybody doesn't have to be as creative as myself or you or other people that I've had the pleasure of dealing with. I think that the leveling of that playing field allow other people who are also creative in different ways to get into the game. But what also forced me to do is raise my game up. So I couldn't rely on just the sounds of the day or the rhythms of the street that I had known. I had to also rely on my musician skills, my composition skills, my arranging skills, my ability to orchestrate. And so that's one of the things that kept me in the game, is because I could always elevate a few levels above what the mainstream was.
So what happened when you decided to raise the game? What was the result of
that?
Well,
what happened then is that people that I was doing things like maybe a 30-second spot or background music for Keeping Up with the Kardashians or whatever, they would hear the amount of music and creativity and craft that went into these spots. And what wound up happening is they started recommending me for bigger and bigger budget products, projects, which led to actually scoring a few films because they could hear that I had those kind of chops. I had that kind of craft.
It's interesting that people recognized it. I mean, it's such a, that kind of technique and that kind of expertise sometimes goes ignored. I mean, what's the difference between the beats and what Wayne's doing right now? I mean, I'm surprised it's subtle, but I'm surprised people recognize
it. I think what happened is it was sometimes I would go, because sometimes I'd be so inspired by what was happening musically that I would go above and beyond of what the spot was. For example, working with, there was this company out of New York that was doing a spot for a company called Carhartt. And they wanted a suite of songs that they could drop in, a suite of music that they could drop into any spot at any time that was interchangeable. So I came up with about 10 to 12 different segments of different textures or whatever based on these three themes. But it seemed to them like it was just this endless reservoir of music. And the gentleman I'm speaking of who headed this company was also getting ready to direct his first independent film. And he asked, can you do this? And I was like, absolutely. So we sat and we spec'd it out. We went over every shot. We went over every beat that he wanted hit or whatever, and off we went. And from that, not to cut you off, but I did four more movies with him. And then other producers and people who were also doing film would either see the work that I had done for him or was involved in the project in some way. And I got other work through that.
How much time do you spend on a project like that, scoring a film?
Well, that's a really good question. And what the correct answer is, whatever the producer tells you, you got. Now, usually what happens is I haven't been part of too many projects where they have not run through all of the budget. So by the time they get to you, the budget that they have to spend on music is very small and your window is very short. So what winds up happening is you wind up putting all the other projects that you have on hold so you can concentrate on this specific thing. So, for example, if you take, let's just say a half hour TV show, let's say a half hour TV show, that's probably 22 minutes worth of music with commercials. That's a lot of music. So you could probably spend probably a month working, not anymore, but when I got started, it probably would have taken me a month to write 22 minutes worth of music and variations on the theme, for sure.
Wow, that's that's a commitment. Now, in addition to being a musician, you're also a programmer. Where'd that come from?
So, being out on the road in the early 2000s, I had been part of quite a few touring top 40 bands and played with Bob James for a while, and I played with Warren Hill for a while. And just being on the road was starting to wear on me a little bit. I wanted to have some kids. I wanted to buy a house, have a just not necessarily a normal life, but maybe a life with a little more balance. And so at this time, the internet, probably early 2000, I think we're talking about 1999, early 2000, 2001, the internet wasn't what it is today. But I saw opportunity to change my life in a sense. And so while I was out on the road, while the other guys would be out partying or as soon as sound check was over, I'd go back to my room, took my laptop, took a couple computer books, and I'd be studying in my room. And so when I felt my skills were high enough, I started applying for jobs. It took me quite a while because my degree was in music, not in computer science, which a lot of people wanted. But I did eventually convince somebody to take a gamble on me. And my skills were crazy high because I had worked on it nonstop for a year. And so once they saw my portfolio, off it went.
Did you, even as that took off, did you miss the creative part of being a musician, or how did you handle
that? Well, so I would say in some ways, music and programming are very similar. You know, you're still dealing with patterns, and there's no one way to write a program. It's a very creative, I know it sounds really dry and boring on the outside, but there are so many ways to get the same result that it becomes another outlet of creativity. And for me, there's something about programming that is very calming and soothing, and it fulfills me in a way that music doesn't. And I mean that not from a negative standpoint, but programming, I can start on a task and complete that task and know that that task is done. And what I set out for the computer to do, it does. Whereas with music, you know, no matter how good on the guitar I get or whatever, there's some 14-year-old farm boy out of Iowa who's going to come along and teach me a few things. And so there's this never-ending pit of hell that I'm constantly chasing with music, whereas programming is kind of not discrete, but it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, if that makes sense.
Do you feel that, and I never considered that, but the idea that there are, as a musician, as good as you are, there's always somebody else up and coming that is going to challenge you? Do you feel that?
I feel, yeah, I think that's just keeping it real. I think in a lot of ways, I can tell you that the road for sure is very hard, and it's a young man's game. Just on a physical sense, I mean, I don't think there's too many people that are come along necessarily and take my gig from me, but they may have more endurance. They may be willing to take so much more for less than myself. I do feel that certain things physically came easier for me when I was younger, but there, the flip side is I didn't have the maturity or the stagecraft to know how to use it. So there's always a trade-off. But yeah, I think there's always somebody breathing down your neck who's coming up that's breathing fire, for sure. For sure. If you get on Instagram or YouTube, it's pretty horrifying out here what some of these kids are doing, without a doubt.
As a musician, do you think as you've aged, and you're not an old man by any stretch, but you're not
right,
20,
that's right.
Do you think you're better than you were when you're younger? Are you getting better with age?
I do think so. That's a really good question. Man, do I appreciate that question. It's so multi-layered. But what I would say is that when you're young, you have this energy that comes off the body, and it's just, you're so excited, and the possibilities of what you think you're going to do and what can be done, it propels you forward through your immaturity and your stupidity and your arrogance, right? And as you get older, you realize the limitations of what you're doing as opposed to this guy or this guy. I mean, you know, I was constantly chasing my heroes. Like, I'm chasing Jeff Beck and John McLaughlin and Jimi Hendrix and Mike Stern. I'm such a, and without realizing that, they're chasing their heroes. And I could never be as good as they are. I can only be as good as I am. And so whatever style that I have came from the limitations of not being able to do what they do, but to do what I do. But when I was a young man, I didn't realize the value of having an identity like that. So I think the answer to your question is, as you get older, you learn the value of what you bring to the table, not judging yourself against what somebody else is bringing. That makes you better.
That's very interesting. I have a theory about music, which is not founded in any kind of reality, because I don't know anything about music except I like to listen to it. But here's my theory. When I hear someone like Thelonious Monk play, I'm intrigued. I'm intrigued with Monk and Mingus especially, because I believe that you can't play something that you don't hear, and that Monk and Mingus and people like that, we're hearing something that most humans don't hear.
Say that is 100% right. 100% right. My philosophy is, has always been, if you watch any great musician playing, they are singing along with their playing. I mean, if you watch Tony Williams play, or Elvin Jones, or Thelonious Monk, or these guys playing, they are always singing along with it. And my philosophy is, you can't sing what you're playing. If you're not expressing yourself, you are just playing things that you've played a million times, but it's not true creativity. It's not expressing yourself. Miles Davis said at one point, the guys that get up and play really fast, he goes, they've played that a million times, but they're not saying anything.
Wow. And I think that's right. I think it's right. Now, here's the thing. You did a K-pop song. You produced a K. How does Wayne Girard end up doing producing a
so
K-pop
song? It's a convoluted story. But after I stopped working over at Shady, I had a what they call a song broker. And how that works is basically it's a guy who has an inside track to what's going on in the industry. So record companies, along with the whatever artists that a record company has on the roster, when it's time for them to record a new record, they reach out to all of the hot producers of the day, the Timberlands, the Dr. Dre's, et cetera, et cetera. But they also reach out to the song brokers. And what these song brokers do is they have a stable of guys who basically write songs in any style. And they have three different levels of guys. They will have a track guy. They'll have a top line guy who writes melody. And then they'll have a lyric person. And what they do is, say, if Christina Aguilera is needing new songs for her new record, well, most of the budget for that record is going to go to Timbaland or David Foster or whoever, but they have money left over for the new and up-and-comers to write songs and get in. This is how somebody that you've never heard of all of a sudden is Drake's new guy, because he had an opportunity that came out of nowhere. Or he was Drake's guy, or whatever. And so my song broker at the time was looking for music for this group, SS501, which was kind of what BTS is now today in as far as the world goes. We were really popular, young, pretty Asian boys who were trying to break through in America with more of an American sound. And so they gave us a spec sheet like they would do almost with an ad. You know, they wanted a Justin Timberlake, Backstreet Boys, 98 Degrees kind of sound. And so I crafted about three or four tracks. I sent them to the song broker. He sent it to his guys. They put lyrics and melody on it. They sent the tune over. And I didn't hear anything else about it probably for 7 months. I had forgotten about it. I was doing other work. And then I got a call from the guy who said, hey, they want to cut your tune. And it's like, wow, that's amazing. And we kind of did a virtual production thing, if you will, a couple Skype sessions. And they cut the vocal and off it went. Now, I thought it was going to be the single. It turned out to not be the single, but the record went platinum anyway, which doesn't mean what it means in America for a platinum record, but it was still, you know, a feather in my cap. So there you go.
Are you turned off by how the music industry has changed over the years?
That's a good question as well, man. You're on fire with the questions. Whenever there's money involved and people can figure out how to monetize a thing, they will do that. And I think that a lot of the creativity has been taken out of it. They're just looking for product now and just the ability to just fill slots and fill shoes. I don't think that, you know, we grew up on Queen and Rick James and Prince and David Bowie, Genesis, Phil Collins. I don't think that the artists of today will still have the longevity as the artists that we grew up with. There will be no Earth, Wind and Fires or Lionel Richie's. That makes me sad. That makes me really sad.
It seems like the idea that you'd have some kind of organic artist like a Prince or somebody, even Earth, Wind & Fire, who kind of their success is very unusual based on how they started, that opportunity doesn't really exist anymore.
The opportunity doesn't exist, but the ability to come up through. I don't want to paint the whole thing as dire and dark because I don't think it's that way. I mean, talent will always break through, whether it's Lizzo or Daniel Caesar or, The Weeknd. Talent will always find a way, right? It will always rise to the top. But I do believe that a lot of music is very disposable, and artists today don't have the same work ethic. I mean, if you think about Prince or Lionel Richie or, you know, Genesis or whatever, these guys came up playing clubs, playing the Chitlin' Circuit, playing 5-6 nights a week, honing their craft, learning how to perform on stage. You see an older rock group, me and my wife watched, I think it was Music Cares in the last couple months, and Aerosmith was the sponsored artist. And I'm telling you, you can just see the road and stagecraft when artists who have been through it come up. And this is why, after almost 40 years in the game, Aerosmith is still as good as they ever were, you know. And so I think there's something to be said for paying the dues and not having an American Idol frame of reference.
Wow, that's interesting. I guess we'll have to stop there. We could talk all day about music, because I love music. But I really appreciate you sharing your insights and spending a little time with the audience from Open Source. How can people find your music, Wayne?
So they can go to WaynePlaysGuitar.com. I have some music there. I am on CD Baby as well. Just look for Wayne Gerard, G-E-R-A-R-D. I also have an Instagram page, which is WGerard211. And they can always find me on Facebook as well, Wayne Gerard Milton. Milton is my last name, actually. Gerard is my middle name. That's my grandfather's first name.
Okay, we'll make that distinction clear. That's it for this time, Wayne. And this is Open Source with Tony Motley. We'll talk to you next time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, man. Thank you.
Open Source is a co-production of Duet Digital Media and McLaughlin Media.